Then in 1898, Luxembourg moved to Germany, and of course at the time, Germany was very much the centre of the international labour movement, and she joined the German Social Democratic Party, the SPD. And she very quickly became a leading member of this party, and certainly the most important figure on the left of the party, because the SPD was a very broad party encompassing a range of political tendencies. Her work within the SPD was focused mainly in the spheres of theory and propaganda. She wrote numerous articles, polemics, pamphlets, and so on for the party press. She spoke at meetings and conferences. She ran the party's schools in Marxism and activities like that. And in 1914, she was one of only a tiny minority within the SPD that actually stuck to Marxist principles, denounced the First World War, unlike the SPD leadership and most of the parties of the Second International, which promptly caved in, capitulated to their governments and their national ruling classes, and supported them in the First World War. Luxembourg, of course, was one of the first to be rounded up in the new war situation. She was put into jail and she remained there for the duration of the war. She was actually only released by the revolution that itself ended the war in 1918. Now, for a long time, Rosa Luxemburg, despite, you know, the terrible betrayal of 1914, which was one of the lowest points of her life, she'd resisted the idea of splitting away from the SPD to create a genuinely revolutionary alternative. Her hand, however, was forced when the SPD itself split virtually down the middle, creating a new centrist organisation called the Independent Social Democratic Party, or USPD, to use its German initials. The little group around Luxembourg called itself the Spartacus League, and they at first operated as a faction within this USPD. But subsequently they left the USPD and became the first communist party outside Russia and the first party to join the new Third International or Comintern that was set up by the Bolsheviks in the wake of the Russian Revolution. But shortly after setting up the Communist Party, in the course of a premature attempted insurrection in Berlin, Luxembourg was arrested and subsequently murdered by right-wing soldiers who were under the command of the new SPD government that had taken over when the Kaiser fled after the revolution. Her body was unceremoniously dumped into a canal and it was only washed up and retrieved 4 months later. Her funeral was a massive affair. A huge crowd turned up, which testified very much to the respect and the love that was felt to her by the working class and the socialist movement in Germany. She was one of the national figures of the SPD and known around the country. Okay, now go back a bit. When Luxembourg first arrived in Germany, the SPD, as I said, was the largest socialist party in the world. It had a mass working class following, and its leaders were seen as the preeminent Marxists of their day. Karl Kautsky, one of the main leaders of the SPD, was known throughout the socialist world as the Pope of Marxism. Lenin very much looked to the SPD, as did most socialists around Europe, looked to the SPD as a model of a socialist party. And he was very close to Kautsky. In fact, he almost revered Kautsky right up to the point of the betrayal of 1914. And in fact, when he saw the party press announcing the betrayal of 1914, Lenin at first thought that this was a forgery that had been put about by the Kaiser's agents in an attempt to discredit socialists and to disorient Europe's revolutionaries. But as Luxembourg discovered when she arrived in Germany, the SPD was very much split between revolutionary currents and reformist currents. And despite the fact that the party platform and program had all this Marxist rhetoric about socialist revolution, the actual political direction and practice of the party was increasingly dominated by the reformists. Luxembourg herself actually broke politically with Kautsky in 1910 because she accused him of laying the basis for a new kind of revisionism. And at the time, Lenin thought her criticisms were vastly exaggerated, and he actually sided with Kautsky. But later on, he admitted, Rosa Luxemburg was right. She realised long ago that Kautsky was a time-serving theorist, serving the majority of the party, in short, serving opportunism. But initially, when Luxemburg first arrived, she was something of a protege of Kautsky, who saw her as a means by which to buttress the left against the right of the party. So despite the fact that she was still very young and, a new member of the party, he gave her the job of writing a polemic against reformism. And this was her first major contribution to Marxist political Marxist theory, a book called Social Reform or Social Revolution. Actually, it's a book now, but it was originally published as a series of articles in the party press in the years 1898 to 99. And I would argue that, this remains the best Marxist critique of the whole reformist project. Now, the theoretical leader of the reformists was a man called Edward Bernstein, a respected party leader who had the aura of having been a friend of Engels. And he was writing at a time when there hadn't been a major slump in Europe, an economic slump, for over two decades. And in the context of this, Bernstein was arguing that capitalism had basically found ways to resolve its contradictions and to avoid the periodic crises which Marx had argued were inevitable. Bernstein claimed that through a range of mechanisms that I don't have time to go into here, but basically that the anarchic nature of the capitalist system was being tamed, it was giving way to a tendency towards stability and increasing prosperity, and indeed permanent prosperity. And this prosperity meant that the working class could improve its economic, social and political conditions via the trade unions and via parliament. And this was very much the basis of reformism. So Bernstein concluded from all this that there was no need for a revolutionary transformation of society, that basically the SPD's task was to assist workers to improve their conditions, and that the party then would eventually win a parliamentary majority through elections and then use that majority to introduce socialism by legislation. So socialism was to be the product of evolution and not revolution. Now, Bernstein's illusions in the ability of Parliament to do this reflected what had become quite a non-Marxist view, really, especially since the experience of the Paris Commune, that things like parliaments and more broadly the state that parliaments are one aspect of, that these are neutral institutions that stand above class society rather than, as revolutionary Marxists have always insisted, a means for the bourgeoisie to dominate and regulate political life. But, of course, Bernstein's theory for many in the SPD, particularly for the parliamentary deputies themselves and for the trade union leaders, they found this theory very, very attractive because, after all, it legitimised their own political practice and it put them, rather than the working class, at the centre of things. And best of all, of course, it did away with any need for all that messy, disruptive class struggle stuff in favour of, you know, a peaceful parliamentary road. Now, in responding to this, Luxembourg insisted that the very processes that Bernstein had identified as, contributing to the increasing stability of capitalism in the 1890s would actually undermine and lead to greater instability later on. And she anticipated the work of Lenin and Bukharin on imperialism when she wrote that capitalist combinations aggravate the contradiction, existing between the international character of the capitalist world economy and the national character of the state, insofar as they are always accompanied by a general tariff war, which sharpens the differences among capitalist states. And her analysis on both these points was utterly vindicated by world events. Firstly, the profound economic crisis that gripped Europe in 1900, and then, of course, World War I, when the imperialist powers of Europe and around the world sent their working classes to slaughter in the trenches as they fought for control over the world's wealth. Now, it wasn't the case that Luxembourg in any way downplayed the importance of workers actually fighting for reforms in the here and now. On the contrary, she saw this as absolutely crucial. She saw it as what she called the school for revolution, the means by which workers could actually learn how to run their own struggles, run their own lives, more broadly run society, and make themselves, in Marx's words, fit to rule. But what she argued was that the fight for reforms had to be linked to the final revolutionary goal and a preparation for it, not a substitute for it, as Bernstein argued. So to Bernstein's proposition that the final goal is nothing, the movement is everything, Luxembourg retorted, "People who pronounce themselves in favour of the method of legislative reform, in place of and in contradistinction to the conquest of political power and social revolution, do not really choose a more tranquil, calmer and slower road to the same goal, but a different goal." Okay, turn now to another topic. Luxembourg was the first to recognise the enormous significance of events in Belgium in the 1890s. This was a time when Belgian workers used mass strikes in order to press their demand for the vote for a greater degree of democracy. Now, unlike many of the leaders of the SPD, Luxembourg enthusiastically welcomed this new form of struggle as a specifically working class weapon. She immediately grasped grasped the revolutionary potential of the mass strike, and she foresaw that strikes like this would be central to the struggle for workers' power. So when a revolution broke out in Russia in 1905 and workers there were also using mass strikes to fight for both their economic and political demands, Luxembourg seized the opportunity to go there and study this phenomenon at first hand, which involved a fair bit of cloak and dagger stuff and working in secrecy and so on. But she was able to observe very closely how that revolution unfolded, how the workers fought. And then she wrote a book about it called The Mass Strike, in which she hailed the mass strike as the natural method to mobilise the broadest proletarian layers into action to revolutionise and organise them. And she explained how this happened. She said, in order that the working class may participate en masse in any direct political action, it must first organise itself, which above all means that it must obliterate the boundaries between factories and workshops, mines and foundries. It must overcome the split between workshops, which the daily yoke of capitalism condemns it to. Therefore, the mass strike is the first natural, spontaneous form of every great revolutionary proletarian action. So what she recognised here was that the mass strike represented this elemental striving for unity on the part of the working class, without which, if they didn't have that unity, they would not be able to win. Luxembourg quite explicitly rejected the false separation between economic struggle on the one hand and political struggle on the other that very much characterised the practice of the SPD. And she saw the potential of the mass strike to overcome this false separation. She said it was simultaneously a means to undermine and overthrow the established state power, as well as to curb capitalist exploitation. And she used the events that she observed in Russia to demonstrate how in a revolutionary period, economic struggle and political struggles grow together. She wrote, "The movement does not only go in one direction, from an economic to a political struggle, but also in the opposite direction. Every important political mass action after reaching its peak results in a series of economic mass strikes. There exists a reciprocal influence between the two struggles. Every fresh attack and victory of the political struggle has a powerful impact on the economic struggle, in that at the same time as it widens the scope for workers to improve their conditions and strengthens their impulse to do so, it enhances their fighting spirit. After every soaring wave of political action, there remains a fertile sediment from which sprout 1,000 economic struggles, and the reverse also applies." And what she understood too was that this interplay of political and economic struggle contributes to a sharp rise in working class consciousness and in confidence. She wrote, "The most precious thing in the sharp ebb and flow of the revolutionary wave is the proletariat's spiritual growth. The advance by leaps and bounds of the intellectual stature of the proletariat affords an inviolable guarantee of its further progress in the inevitable economic and political struggles ahead." And again, I would argue that Luxembourg's analysis and nature of the potential of mass strikes is indispensable for any socialist, any organisation who wants to understand how the revolutionary process can unfold and how we can intervene in it. So both Reform and Revolution and the Mass Strike, I would argue, remain key works of Marxist theory and analysis, and they're as relevant today as when she wrote them. Okay, to turn now to a couple of the more controversial areas. Firstly, on the question of the Revolutionary Party. Now, there's a very persistent myth that Luxembourg was anti-organisation, and in particular, that she was hostile to Lenin and the Bolsheviks. And the first point I'd like to make in response to this is that from the age of 11, remember, Luxembourg was a member of a revolutionary organisation for her entire life. She lived her entire life within the boundaries of revolutionary organisations, and usually she was a leading member of them. Her belief in the absolute necessity of organisation actually overrode her very strong misgivings about the conservative nature of the SPD. And the depth of her conviction on this question is indicated in a letter she wrote in 1908 to a friend who was, you know, really pissed off with the conservatism and was thinking of leaving the party. And Luxembourg said, "We cannot be outside the organisation, out of contact with the masses. The worst of workers' parties is better than nothing." She despised sectarianism and she feared isolation from the workers' movement pretty much in equal measure. And she was probably influenced to a great extent in this by what had happened in 1891 in Germany, when quite a large group of revolutionaries had split away from the SPD. They'd set up a new organisation called the Independent Socialist Party, which had a very brief life and then sank without a trace. And this was not an experience that Luxembourg wanted to repeat. What she hoped instead was that the revolutionaries would be able to recapture the SPD. they'd be able to drive out the right and win back the party for its members, as she put it. Now, perhaps this ambition was somewhat naive, you could argue, and this was certainly forcibly demonstrated in 1917 when it was actually the SPD right who drove out their opposition, both the left, represented by Luxembourg, and the centrists. Now, her failure to split from the SPD and to begin to cohere a genuine revolutionary alternative, certainly after 1914, if not earlier, was a serious error. But it's important to stress it as well, that this reluctance was in no way a cover for making any concessions at all to reformism. The differences between Luxembourg and Lenin on questions of party organisation arose partly out of the fact that they worked in very, very different historical situations. Luxembourg's views on the danger of over-centralisation and the inherently conservative nature of party leadership were very much a product of her first-hand observations of how the SPD worked. She worked in an environment where bureaucratic centralism was, in fact, the main problem. The SPD was a mass party. It was operating in legal conditions. It had a huge apparatus, huge party machine, and a whole layer of privileged officials. Very, very different from the situation in which Lenin and the Bolsheviks were operating in Russia. The SPD leadership very much emphasised the factor of organisation, and it discounted the spontaneous action of the masses, which was something it tended to regard with a mixture of fear and mistrust. And so Luxembourg's fight against this propensity of the SPD leadership led her very much to bend the stick in the opposite direction, emphasising much more the factor of working class spontaneity. But we shouldn't shy away from the fact that there were also underlying theoretical differences. When she was writing to criticise some of Lenin's formulations in What Is to Be Done, Luxembourg wrote, "The social democracy," by which she meant the revolutionary parties, organisations, "the social democracy is not joined to the organisation of the proletariat, it is itself the proletariat." Now, as you can see, this is not at all a conception of a vanguard party such as Lenin developed. But it does, as I said, very much reflect the reality of the SPD, which is a very broad party containing a range of political tendencies. And also, she tended to see the role of the party as being primarily one of propaganda and education, rather than organising the masses and calling them to action, because she believed that that was something that would happen more or less spontaneously. Now, for all her insight, her first-hand experience, her criticisms of the conservatism of the SPD and the union leaders, Luxembourg did seriously underestimate their ability to hold back and disorient the working class. In 1913, she wrote, "Leaders who hang back will certainly be pushed aside by the storming masses." Now, obviously, this testifies to the enormous faith that Luxembourg put in the revolutionary activity of the working class. But while she certainly had a very well-justified appreciation of the heights to which working-class consciousness could rise in struggle, she did somewhat tend to overestimate the evenness of this development within the working class. She tended to see it as being a sort of fairly uniform thing rather than having ups and downs and so on. And so when the crunch came in the German revolutionary period in 1918-19, the SPD leaders were actually able to exploit the long-established allegiance of millions of workers that they enjoyed to then sabotage the revolution. In 1918, the newly formed Communist Party was tiny, it was inexperienced, and it was lacking in organisational cohesiveness. Karl Radek from Russia was there participating in this process. He reported that in Berlin, the Communist Party had something like 50 organised members, and at the end of the party conference, he commented, "I really didn't feel like I was present in the presence of a party." That's how things. That's how young, inexperienced it was. So this was an organisation that was utterly incapable, with the best will in the world, of leading the revolutionary upheaval that followed the war. Unlike the Bolsheviks, the KPD, as it was called, didn't have a disciplined cadre that had been steeled in battles and tactics over a number of years. It didn't have the layer of experienced revolutionaries who had the authority and credibility among the masses to win masses of workers away from the reformist and centrist parties who were competing for their allegiance. What's more, the KPD's very youthful enthusiasm led it into all sorts of ultra-left errors, and in the end being drawn into, as I said, a hopelessly premature uprising in Berlin. Now, Luxembourg recognised these problems, but she was, despite her personal standing, she was powerless to stop any of this, and she paid for it with her life. It would appear that Luxembourg's ideas on organisations did actually grow closer to Lenin's as the German Revolution unfolded. On January the 11th in 1918, she wrote, "The absence of leadership, the non-existence of a centre to organise the Berlin working class cannot continue. If the cause of the revolution is to advance, if the victory of the proletariat, of socialism, is to be anything but a dream, the revolutionary workers must set up leading organisations able to guide and to utilise the combative energy of the masses." Don't know about you, but it sounds like a vanguard party to me. Now, it's true that Luxembourg had a whole series of disagreements with Lenin and the Bolsheviks, but I think her criticisms have to be seen in the context of her wholehearted support for the October Revolution. She wrote, "The Bolsheviks have shown that they are capable of everything that a genuine revolutionary party can contribute within the limits of the historical possibilities. Lenin and Trotsky and their friends were the first, those who went ahead as an example to the proletariat of the world. They are still the only ones who can cry with Hutten, 'I have dared.'" And I'm sorry, I don't know who Hutten was. It's probably some literary allusion. She continued, "Whatever a party could offer of courage, revolutionary far-sightedness and consistency in an historic hour, Lenin, Trotsky and the other comrades have given in good measure. All the revolutionary honour and capacity which Western social democracy lacked was represented by the Bolsheviks. Their October uprising was not only the actual salvation of the Russian Revolution, it was also the salvation of the honour of international socialism." And she concluded this passage with the ringing endorsement that the future everywhere belongs to Bolshevism. So Luxembourg was actually one of the very, very few to give immediate and unconditional support to the October Revolution. And like Lenin and Trotsky, she was fully alive to the danger that this revolution would be isolated. While her erstwhile colleagues in the SPD were lamenting that the revolution, "Oh, it's terrible, it's premature, it's, you know, it's a terrible mistake," as they condemned the Bolsheviks as adventurers, Luxembourg's take was this: "These fears result from the objective situation of the Bolsheviks and not from their subjective behaviour. Without the German Revolution, the Russian Revolution remains in danger and the fight for socialism in this worldwide war is futile. There is only one solution, the large-scale uprising of the German working class." And this very much echoes the kinds of things Lenin and Trotsky themselves were saying. I think Lenin said, "The truth is, without a revolution in Germany, we are doomed." So Luxembourg's criticisms of the Bolsheviks in this period were very much tempered by the acknowledgement that without international revolutionary support, as she wrote, "even the greatest energy and the greatest sacrifices of the proletariat in a single country must inevitably become tangled in a maze of contradictions and blunders." So Luxembourg's criticisms of the Bolsheviks, I don't think, provide any comfort whatsoever to opponents of revolutionary socialism. They're well within the framework and traditions of Marxism and, you know, sort of follow the maxim of Marx himself, which was merciless criticism of all things existing. Okay, just to turn briefly to the national question, since I'm running out of time. Like her attitudes to party organisation, I think Luxembourg's position on the national question was very much conditioned by her own circumstances and experience. Poland was an oppressed country that was divided between no fewer than three empires, and so for Polish revolutionaries, it was a pretty immediate, urgent and concrete question. I haven't got time to go into all the details of how she arrived at this analysis, but Luxembourg concluded that the only way that Poland could actually win national independence concretely was by the intervention of one of these imperialist powers. And this belief was very much strengthened and reinforced by the role and the behaviour of the right-wing Polish Socialist Party, or PPS. PPS was essentially a nationalist outfit, paid lip service to socialism, but ended up pretty much in the service of the Habsburg Empire. And Luxembourg's struggle against the PPS coloured her entire attitude to the national question. She concluded not only that the slogan of national independence itself had no progressive value whatsoever, but that it was a reactionary diversion for the workers' movement. And while she developed this position in relation to her immediate situation in Poland, she tended to generalise it to apply to all national struggles. Now, Lenin agreed with Luxembourg in her opposition to the PPS, obviously. He also agreed that the Polish socialists should work for unity between Polish and Russian workers. But Lenin was in a very different position. He was a member of the oppressor rather than the oppressed nation. And so his main concern was to counter great Russian chauvinism within the Russian workers' movement. And he argued that the way to do this, and also the way to win allies among the oppressed nations rather than turning them into enemies, was to support their right to national independence. But while we don't want to understate these differences between Luxemburg and Lenin on these questions, again, I think it's very important to see them in perspective and in their historical context. And I think Tony Cliff in his little book puts it quite nicely. He says, Rosa Luxemburg, proceeding from the struggle against Polish nationalism, inclined to a nihilistic attitude to the national question. Lenin saw realistically that the positions of the oppressed and oppressor nations being different, their attitude to the same question must be different. Thus, starting from different and opposing situations, they proceed in opposite directions to reach the same point of international workers' unity. Okay, so just to conclude, Rosa Luxemburg fully deserves a prominent and honoured place in the revolutionary Marxist tradition. Her path-breaking critique of reformism, her analysis of the mass strike, these things are a precious legacy for us today, and her commitment to building mass revolutionary organisation to lead the fight for socialism remains an inspiration. We stand in the same tradition of revolutionary Marxism as Rosa Luxemburg, and I would argue that attempts to put her outside this tradition are absolutely contemptible. The myth that's very much around the left that she was an anti-Leninist was one that was first invented by Stalinists, but then subsequently people like reformists and anarchists seized on this myth and used it as a way to attack Lenin. As I hope I've demonstrated on the really crucial political questions, Luxemburg and Lenin were in the end very close. And whatever the differences were between them, they did agree on the fundamentals of Marxism. The need for revolution to destroy capitalism and bring about socialism, the central role of the working class in this process, the absolute necessity of revolutionary organisation to cohere and to lead the workers' struggle, and internationalism. So their differences were differences between comrades, not between those on opposite sides of the class line. Rosa Luxemburg unquestionably belongs to us. Despite all the difficulties and setbacks that she faced in her life, and there were very many of them that I haven't had time to go into, Luxemburg never, for one moment, gave up on the struggle. She never lost her faith in the ability of the working class to transform the world. Her indomitable revolutionary spirit and her allegiance to the working class, I think, are best expressed in her own words. Here I stand. I can do nothing else.